content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. We are reading this week from the June 10th, 2016 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Clinton on the defensive over email report. What happened? Hillary Clinton continued to defend her use of a private email server during her tenure as Secretary of State this week, following the release of a scathing report into the practice by the State Department Inspector General. The report, which also criticized some of Clinton's predecessors for using private email accounts while in office, contradicted the likely Democratic nominee's repeated assertions that she hadn't broken any rules. It found that she and her staff had neither sought nor received permission to use private email for official business, had violated her department's record-keeping regulations, and had ignored warnings that hackers were targeting personal email accounts. Clinton's correspondence would have been subject to Freedom of Information scrutiny had she used a State Department server. Although she handed over 30,000 emails to investigators after the private server's existence came to light, she also unilaterally decided to delete another 32,000 that she deemed personal. In an email revealed in that report, Clinton rejected an aide's suggestion that she used a State Department email address because, I don't want any risk of the personal being accessible. In interviews over the past week, Clinton repeated her earlier admissions that she'd made a mistake, but insisted she had known she was breaking the rules. I thought it was allowed, she said. Asked why she refused to be interviewed for the report, she said it was because she had already said everything I could on this matter. Clinton's handling of classified documents on her server remains the subject of a separate FBI investigation. Senator Bernie Sanders, her rival for the Democratic nomination, said the State Department report was something the American people, Democrats, and delegates are going to take a hard look at. What the editorial said: it is now clear Clinton fully understood the security risks of her homebrew server, said the Wall Street Journal. She and her staff received multiple warnings that it could be compromised, and her tech consultant flagged two attempted hackings. The bottom line is that Clinton broke the rules and then lied about it. Voters should understand that this is precisely the kind of governance Clinton would return to the White House. The IG's report will fuel doubts about Clinton's trustworthiness, said the New York Times. Having initially tried to brush this whole scandal off as a partisan flack, she then promised to cooperate fully with the investigators, a promise that she did not honor. The former First Lady remains in her usual defensive posture, but if she wants to stop this issue damaging her campaign any further, she needs to address it thoroughly and candidly. What the columnist said: this email scandal is getting worse with every passing month, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. For Democrats, the biggest concern is why Clinton set up a system to shield her correspondence in the first place. You don't have to be a Trump-style conspiracy monger to think she may be hiding something very damaging, such as using her power as Secretary of State to help foreign donors to the Clinton Foundation. Another worry is the insularity of her staff, said Peter Beinart in TheAtlantic.com. At the State Department, Clinton surrounded herself with longtime loyalists who shared her bunker mentality and never told her when she was wrong. Failure to escape this self-made bubble will undoubtedly imperil her chances of winning the White House. Clinton may have violated some State Department protocols, but there's still no evidence she did anything illegal, said Ed Kilgore in NYMag.com. its false equivalence to compare her email problems to Donald Trump openly threatening press freedoms, proudly championing war crimes, and cheerfully channeling misogyny and ethnic and racial grievances. Trump's untrustworthiness is on a whole other level and is deeply frightening. If Clinton's email defense sounds familiar, said William McGurn in the Wall Street Journal, that's because it's the same one she and her husband have used in Whitewater, the Lewinsky affair, and every scandal. There is no evidence of a crime. But even if there was no law broken, Clinton deliberately chose to put American security at risk by using her own server, refused to cooperate with investigators, and repeatedly lied. Whether or not she broke any laws, her behavior is hardly irrelevant to her fitness for the White House. And a second main story this week, the fierce fight to retake Fallujah from ISIS control. What happened? Humanitarian groups warned of an unfolding human catastrophe in Fallujah this week after Iraqi forces backed by U.S.-led airstrikes launched a long-awaited offensive to retake the city from ISIS. Amid reports that the jihadist group was herding hundreds of civilians into the center of the city to use as human shields. Located 35 miles west of Baghdad, Fallujah has been in ISIS hands since January 2014, and along with Mosul is one of the militant group's two remaining strongholds in Iraq. After pushing into southern suburb of Noumea, Iraqi troops delayed their assault in a bid to protect 50,000 civilians still trapped in the city. ISIS fighters fought back ferociously, using tunnels, deploying snipers, and sending six explosive-laden cars that were destroyed before they reached their targets. Iranian-backed Shiite militias are also taking part in the offensive, but were ordered to stay out of the main assault amid fears they would conduct sectarian reprisals against Fallujah's majority Sunni population. Shiite religious leader Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani urged the militants to exhibit restraint in the coming months, telling them to abide by the standard behaviors of jihad. What the columnist said, Operation Save Haider al-Abadi has now begun in Iraq, said Max Boot in CommentaryMagazine.com. That's not the official name of the Fallujah offensive, but it might as well be, given that the Iraqi prime minister teeters on the edge of total powerlessness. In recent weeks, ISIS suicide bombers have killed 200 people in Baghdad, and protesters loyal to Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr again invaded the city's green zone, the heart of the Iraqi government. The Fallujah assault is al-Abadi's last-ditch attempt to show his government is not entirely feeble. There's one bright spot in this mess, said Daniel DePetris in nationalinterest.org. If ISIS was a movement on the march in 2014, it is now an organization that is suffering incredible territorial losses. Sinjar has been retaken, as have towns like Ramadi and Shadadi. The jihadist group's oil finances have been halved, and its recruitment of foreign fighters has plummeted from 2,000 a month to about 200. A successful ground operation in Fallujah would be yet another setback. There's no doubt Iraqi and U.S. forces will win in Fallujah. They always do, said Jeremy Shapiro in Vox.com. The problem is what happens once ISIS is gone and the Iraqi government takes over. This is the third time Iraqi and U.S. forces have retaken the city from insurgents. The first came in 2004, after four U.S. military contractors were dragged through the streets, burned, and hung from a bridge. The second came just months later and claimed the lives of nearly 100 U.S. soldiers. After both bloody battles, the U.S. looked on as the Iraqi government oppressed local Sunnis, pushing them into the arms of insurgents. The same thing will inevitably happen again after Abadi's shaky leadership. If Fallujah has come to represent anything, it's the utter pointlessness of U.S. efforts in Iraq. Our controversy of the week, media, a billionaire's revenge on Gawker. Billionaire Peter Thiel has just given every rich businessman a dangerous blueprint for subverting America's free press, said Felix Salmon in Fusion.net. Thiel, an eccentric Silicon Valley entrepreneur who co-founded PayPal and was an early investor in Facebook, admitted last week he's been funding a secret decade-long legal war against Gawker Media. Back in 2007, Gawker outed Thiel, saying he is totally gay. Rather than suing the website himself, Thiel secretly bankrolled multiple lawsuits by other people who felt they'd been wronged by the aggressive website and its founder, Nick Denton. The biggest of these cases involved former pro wrestler Hulk Hogan, who sued for invasion of privacy after Gawker published footage of Hogan having sex with a friend's wife. In March, a Florida jury awarded Hogan a stunning $140 million, enough to put Gawker out of business unless the site wins an appeal or gets the judgment reduced. Thiel portrays his war against Gawker as a public service in behalf of the less prominent, far less wealthy people who've been targeted by the site and can't fight back. But the strategy he's used to cripple and intimidate Gawker could be used by any billionaire against any media organization. We should all be very afraid. The real fight here is about privacy and not freedom of the press, said Mark Randazza in CNN.com. Gawker's editors deliberately invaded Thiel's and Hogan's privacy, choosing to embarrass them for no reason other than their own amusement and some extra traffic to their site. There's nothing illegal about the two men joining forces and working within the legal system to hold Gawker accountable. It's no different from when, say, the ACLU joins a third party's freedom of speech lawsuit, or the Sierra Club backs a farmer's lawsuit against a mining company. Thiel's critics would be on much firmer ground if he hadn't actually won the case, said David Harsanyi in TheFederalist.com. But after a trial, a jury found that Gawker had indeed crossed the line in publishing the sex video of Hogan. The only precedent set here is that we've probably seen the end of sites posting private sex tapes without permission. Free speech will survive without celebrity sex videos. Why the secrecy, though? Asked Jack Schaefer in Politico.com. If Thiel felt he had a legitimate case against Gawker and Denton, he should have brought it in his own name. Would Thiel's defenders be as comfortable with his behavior if he had secretly financed a lawsuit against the New York Times instead of Gawker? Gawker may be a reprehensible publication, said Vivek Wadhwa in WashingtonPost.com, but it's one of the few media organizations that have reported aggressively on the tech sector. Silicon Valley power brokers like Thiel have access to resources that rival those of governments. And as they continue to reshape our world, the checks and balances provided by a fearless press are needed more than ever. Pointing and laughing at someone's private life is neither a check nor a balance, said Megan McArdle in BloombergView.com. Don't get me wrong, I find the idea of billionaires using their power and money to put media companies out of business to be deeply worrisome. But it's actually really hard to sue a media organization in America, thanks to our robust First Amendment protections. Gawker is facing extinction not because of fearless reporting on Thiel's business, but because it violated common human decency in publishing a sex video. The jury's verdict and Thiel's involvement may make other media organizations more wary in the future, but this isn't the end of journalism as we know it. It was a good week for sticking a cork in it after a group of New York boaters plugged a hole in their sinking ship with a cork from a bottle of Absolut vodka. "We tried everything, but nothing worked," boater Michael Clapman said. "Thankfully, the alcohol saved the day." It was a good week for dinner with a friend after a restaurant in Sweden began offering a special menu just for dogs. "Most dogs prefer beef," said proprietor Tobias Hamburg. And it was a good week for ties after the Scripps National Spelling Bee crowned co-champions for the third straight year when Nihar Janga, 11, of Austin, and Jairam Hathwar, 13, of Painted Post, New York, both made it through the 25 rounds of competition. Janga's final word was Gelshaft, while Hathwar's was Feldenkrais. But it was a bad week for must-see TV after Donald Trump proposed a debate with Bernie Sanders to raise funds for charity and backed out the next day. "What are you afraid of, Mr. Trump?" said Sanders, mockingly calling him a big, tough guy. And it was a bad week for Glenn Beck after the conservative pundit was suspended by Sirius XM Radio for allowing a guest to speculate that citizens may have to use extra-legal means to overthrow a Trump presidency. Sirius said it could not condone advocating harm against an individual currently running for office. And it was a bad week for sex education in Kentucky after blogger Ryan Nickum examined the most common Google searches to find out which state asked certain questions more than other states, folks in the bluegrass state were most likely to ask, "How to make a baby." On the briefing page, our article is titled, "American Isolationism." Donald Trump's vow to put America first taps into sentiments that date to the Republic's founding. What is isolationism? In its purest form, it's a nation's total retreat from the world stage. The term, however, usually describes a policy of non-interventionism, avoiding foreign alliances and conflicts, and waging war only if attacked. Much of U.S. history reflects an ambivalent tension between the desire to withdraw from messy foreign problems and the belief America should serve as a dominant force in world affairs. The indispensable nation, as former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright put it, isolationist sentiment has ebbed and flowed, often surging during the hard economic times or in the wake of costly wars. Donald Trump's promise to put America first thus echoes many previous eras in our history, dating back to the founders. How were the founders isolationist? They saw America's geographical separation from Europe as an ideal opportunity to cultivate the new nation in solitude. Our detached and distant situation invites and enables us to pursue a different course, George Washington said in his 1796 farewell address. Thomas Jefferson, too, warned against entangling alliances, though he waged war when North Africa's Barbary pirates started seizing American merchant ships. With the notable exception of the successful 1846-48 Mexican War, which expanded U.S. borders to include California and much of the West, the young nation disdained military adventures in other parts of the world. America does not go abroad in search of monsters to destroy, Secretary of State John Quincy Adams declared in 1821. When did isolationism end? A turning point was the Spanish-American War. During Cuba's revolt against Spain in 1898, President William McKinley sent the battleship Maine on a goodwill visit to Havana, where it blew up in the harbor, killing more than 250 U.S. sailors. Historians now believe an internal explosion destroyed the ship, but at the time Americans, egged on by jingoistic press, blamed Spain, and the U.S. declared war. After 4 months, Spain surrendered, ceding Guam, Puerto Rico, and the Philippines to the U.S. The conflict made a national hero and vice president of Theodore Roosevelt, the charismatic leader of the Volunteer Rough Riders Regiment. When Roosevelt succeeded to the presidency after McKinley's assassination in 1901, he pursued a muscular foreign policy. His credo was speak softly and carry a big stick. To promote U.S. interests abroad, he ordered the construction of the Panama Canal and negotiated the end of the Russo-Japanese War. Though sometimes bellicose, says historian Richard Abrams, T.R. also prodded Americans to assume the responsibility to use their power for good internationality, for good internationally. What revived isolationism? Chiefly, it was a horrified response to World War I. The U.S. entered the war to end all wars in 1917, unleashing a burst of flag-waving fervor. But the sickening carnage in Europe, 17 million dead and another 20 million wounded, sparked a long period of isolationism. Americans withdrew into the pursuit of money and fun during the prosperous 1920s, and in the depression-ravaged 30s, worried more about putting food on the table than about the rise of militaristic dictatorships in Europe and Japan. President Franklin D. Roosevelt recognized the threat, but could not control the isolationist Congress, said the late historian Arthur Schlesinger, Jr. When war finally broke out in 1939, it did not destroy isolationism, Schlesinger said. Rather, it ushered in the most intense and angry debate of my lifetime and gave rise to the American First, America First Committee. What did that group believe? Founded at Yale Law School in 1940, America First argued that the U.S. should not sacrifice the lives of young men to solve European problems. AFC ranks swelled to 800,000, including future President Gerald Ford, Walt Disney, architect Frank Lloyd Wright, and most prominently, hero aviator Charles Lindbergh. The group demanded U.S. neutrality in Germany's war with Britain, advocated a negotiated peace with Hitler, and strenuously opposed FDR's Lend-Lease Act, which sent arms and aircraft to Britain. The peacetime draft, instituted in 1940 to ensure preparedness, was especially polarizing, says Lynn Olson, author of Those Angry Days, Roosevelt, Lindbergh, and America's Fight Over the World War II. The AFC descended on Capitol Hill, joined by anti-war groups with mothers in their titles. Dressed in black, many with veils covering their faces, the women made life miserable for members of Congress who were not avowedly isolationist, Olson said. They stalked their targets, screamed, and spat at them. What happened to the AFC? It disbanded days after Pearl Harbor. World War II began decades of international engagement, with the U.S. emerging as a superpower. In the Cold War that followed, isolationism receded, though its seeds were preserved by libertarians. After the failure of the prolonged Iraq and Afghanistan wars and the insecurity bred by the 2008 recession, isolationist sentiments once again swelled. In a 2013 Pew poll, 52% of Americans agreed the country should mind its own business internationally. Only 20% agreed with that statement in 1962. What we're seeing today is something like isolationism, but not to the extent of the 1920s and 30s, says political scientist James Miernick. The internet, an increasingly globalized economy, and the international reach of terrorism all make isolationism a much harder sell today, Miernick says. We can no longer just close up shop and forget the world. Moving on to the best columns now, we'll take two this week from the U.S. The first, how to curb presidential power. For the good of our country, Americans need to elect a white male Republican as president, said Glenn Reynolds. That may sound stunningly racist, but it may be the only way to wake up the liberal mainstream media to the dangers of an imperial presidency. While Barack Obama brazenly expanded executive power over the past 8 years, a pundit class dominated by lefties shrugged or looked the other way because, well, they agreed with Obama's goals. But now that liberals are terrified by the prospect of a Donald Trump presidency, large swaths of the commentariat finally see sweeping executive power as a possible threat to the republic. It's an outrage, we're told, when Trump makes veiled threats to journalists, though Obama had his minions seize journalists' phone records and threaten to imprison a New York Times reporter if he didn't reveal the source of a leak. Obama has used executive orders to bypass Congress on new immigration and environmental policies and sent troops into war zones without authorization. The press attacked anyone who objected to those abuses of power as partisan and probably a racist to boot. But with a white male Republican in the White House, all criticisms would be presumed valid. Rubio shows his true colors. Senator Marco Rubio used to describe Donald Trump as a con artist who was wholly unprepared to be president, said Philip Klein. Apparently, it takes one to know one. Rubio last week said that for the sake of uniting the party against Hillary Clinton, he would be honored to speak on Trump's behalf at the GOP convention. What a stunningly craven turnaround. During his failed primary run for the nomination, the Florida senator warned that Trump's election would bring chaos and called his divisive rhetoric and the violence at his rallies frightening, grotesque, and disturbing. Rubio expressed fear of giving control over America's nuclear arsenal to a lunatic. But now that Trump has secured the nomination, Rubio is minimizing his objections as policy differences and genuflecting to the man who taunted him as Little Marco. Maybe we shouldn't be surprised. After all, Rubio once embraced comprehensive immigration reform, then jettisoned his own proposal because it was an obstacle to his presidential ambitions. Now he's embracing a demagogue to show party loyalty. Rubio once pretended to be an inspirational moral leader, but Trump has exposed him as just another opportunistic politician with his finger to the wind. And this is a How They See Us column, The Lessons of Hiroshima. Japan commends President Obama for his symbolic and moving visit to Hiroshima last week, said Yomiuri Shimbun in an editorial. The first sitting U.S. president to visit the scene of the atomic devastation his country wreaked, Obama bowed his head and laid a wreath at Hiroshima Peace Memorial Park. "We listened to a silent cry," Obama said. "A wall of fire destroyed a city and demonstrated that mankind possessed the means to destroy itself." The president did not say his country was wrong to drop the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but his words and his manner showed an underlying understanding of the inhumane nature of nuclear weapons and the atrocity of war. Some Japanese expected more from Obama, said Ayako Mii in the Japan Times. Though the White House had made it clear there would be no apology, some hibakusha, as survivors are known, nevertheless hoped for some words of regret, something more than condolences. Meanwhile, back in the U.S., Obama's political rivals have been mocking him as weak for having made the visit at all. The difference in approach highlights a great cultural gulf regarding the concept of apology. Japan is more emotional, the U.S. more litigious and contract-based. In Japan, showing remorse is advantageous. If a leader admits responsibility, the people will forgive. But in the U.S., leaders must consider the legal consequences of admitting a mistake. Ultimately, most Japanese understand this difference. And in surveys, three-quarters of them said they did not require an apology. What we want, said the Asahi Shimbun, is a guarantee that no other humans will ever experience such a horror. The instant incineration of tens of thousands of men, women, and children, and for survivors, the searing pain of radiation burns and years of after effects. Obama included in his Hiroshima speech a pledge, "We have known the agony of war. Let us now find the courage together to spread peace and pursue a world without nuclear weapons." These are beautiful words, but without action, they will be empty ones. Despite all Japan suffered, our security is entirely dependent on the American nuclear umbrella. We must change that. The U.S. and Japan, the nuclear superpower and the only country to experience nuclear devastation, are uniquely placed to design and build a security regime, not just for us but for the world, that is not dependent on nuclear arms. That would be a fitting legacy for Obama's pilgrimage to Hiroshima. That seems like a naive fantasy, said The Nation from Thailand. Obama first called for the abolition of nukes back in 2009, yet still the planet bristles with nuclear warheads, and his country brandishes thousands. Meanwhile, rogue states and terrorists are gaining atomic capability, while increasing tensions between the U.S. and China could yet trigger war, even nuclear war. Sadly, despite the lessons of Hiroshima, the noble concept of nuclear disarmament has never found traction. And now to the last word, our in-depth article, titled this week, "A Hotel Run by Robots." The world's first hotel, staffed almost entirely by automated desk clerks, bellhops, and porters, has opened in Japan. Writer Gideon Lewis Krause books himself a room, hoping to get a glimpse of our robotic future. Japan has a national gift for holding in balance the stateliness of tradition and the marvel of novelty. So it ought to come as no surprise that on the western margin of the archipelago, on a serene bay in a remote area of the Nagasaki Prefecture, there is an enormous theme park dedicated to the splendors of Imperial Holland. It follows with perfect logic that the historical theme park's newest lodging place is the world's first hotel staffed almost entirely by robots. The hotel, even before it opened last summer, received extensive coverage in the international and domestic press for its promise of novel ease and convenience. But when I arrived at the Hui Ten Bosch theme park very late one humid summer night, just days after the fanfare of the robot hotel's ribbon cutting, nobody was quite sure where it might be found. Even the employees of the resort's Hotel Okura, a towering replica of Amsterdam's Centrale Station, replete with stone reliefs and mansard roofs, discovered themselves unable to come to my aid. In rudimentary Japanese, I asked where one might find the Hinna Hotel. The name is an untranslatable double entendre. The literal meaning is strange hotel, but it's very close to the word for evolve, and it's designed to acknowledge the slight uncanniness that might attend the coming hospitality singularity. The dual meaning, however, seemed lost on the Okura's concierge, whose rigorous training hadn't prepared her to counsel swarthy, disreputable-seeming, late-arriving foreigners in search of evolved accommodation. I did a little craftwork automation dance to clear things up, but it only seemed to alarm her further. She bowed and looked at her feet, then busied herself at her drawer, eventually withdrawing a map at the park and its environs at almost 400 acres. Hui Ten Bosch is nearly the size of Monaco. Her pen hovered over the park's periphery at the verge of the bosky hills that surround Mock Holland. Maybe, she said, it is here. Her pen landed on one of the map's empty green spaces. Arigatou gozaimasu, I said, bowing with great weariness. My journey, taxi flight, walk, flight, taxi train, had taken 24 hours, and I looked forward to interacting with no more humans en route to a dreamless sleep. The parking lot was oceanically vast and empty, filled only with air that wadded like cotton. Even the park's entrance show tune Muzak was rendered sluggish by the humidity, reaching the parking lot in muted waves. Beneath the Muzak was the screeching static of cicadas, and underneath that, absolute silence. At the top of a slight rise, I came around a bend to find a robot sentry standing watch. The robot was at least 12 feet tall, with a waspish exoskeleton plated in porcelain white and a tiny head. In the middle distance hung a huge white Ferris wheel, which sat unmoving to a Muzak interpretation of the theme to 2001, A Space Odyssey. From the outside, the hotel was white and boxy and modular, an interlocking assemblage that had obviously been clicked together on site. The glass door slid open, revealing a small anteroom lined with rows and rows of bone-colored orchids. A second set of sliding glass doors parted, and a large furry creature, like an overgrown tooth lined in pink felt, cocked its head and welcomed me, first in Japanese and then in English, to the robot hotel. At first check-in counter was a small toy robot with a friendly face and sparkling pupils. One counter over stood a young female android in a buttoned white tunic with a round white bellhop cap over a side-parted cascade of black hair and a scarf tied around her neck. A small sign in front of her said that she spoke only Japanese. She bent her head silently forward and smiled. The third lane advised that here English was spoken. Behind the desk, wearing a periwinkle bow tie, a bellhop cap, and a neckbeard, was a human-scale velociraptor. It reared back and lifted its talons as if preparing for a hug, and its jaws twitched and stuttered. The female android glanced over and blinked slowly. I approached the floor mat, where two velociraptors' prints indicated where one was supposed to stand for check-in. The velociraptor bowed deeply. "Welcome to the Hinna Hotel," it said in an understated clinical growl. "Thank you for having me," I began, but the velociraptor cut me off. "If you want to check in, please press 1, it said, before continuing on incomprehensibly. On the counter in front of it was a little stack of analog registration forms. "Please say your name in full," the velociraptor said. The robot voice, whose only concession to human or dinosaur speech was a throatily serrated edge, came from a speaker somewhere below and behind the counter. The velociraptor requested that I check in at a touch panel. I entered my name, inserted a credit card, and got a receipt for a room in the B wing. The screen asked me to direct my attention to the facial recognition tower in front of me for keyless entry, while the machine authenticates your face. The velociraptor idly flexed its talons. "Check-in is all finished," he said. "Enjoy your comfortable stay." The velociraptor bowed very slowly and deeply, the sort of bow one intermittently practices on the off chance that one might one day encounter the emperor. My room was at the most distant end of the farthest corridor. It seemed clear I was the only person in the entire wing. I touched the blinking lozenge that said scan, and a blue light shone forth from a little black surveillance globe. The door clicked open. The room was quite large by the standards of Japanese hotels. You could hold your arms out and spin and not touch all the walls. And as I walked in, the lights snapped on in orderly fashion. I was startled by a tinny little girl's voice, which spoke to me in Japanese from a plastic pink robot doll at the bedside. It was mostly head, with two yellow antennas emanating from the crown. It chatted with me as I approached. A small laminated card in front of the robot advised me that it was called Churi-chan. The card suggested one call out Churi-chan's name, to which it would reply, "Nandeshuka," or "May I help you?" If the card continued, "Red LED is on of neck. Please talk following sentences." The sentences included questions about the time, the weather, the room temperature, the weather tomorrow, the prospects of turning the lights on and off, and the offer of a morning call. There was a little drawing of how to properly massage the pink tooth turnip's forehead to encourage its silence. The bottom line referred either to Churi-chan, who could only reply in Japanese, or to the authors of the card itself. We are still studying English version at this time. The hotel itself, needless to say, lacks a human labor approach when it comes to its guests. But for the press, the owners made available a passel of enthusiastic attachés. Mine was Takata-san, who arrived dressed in a black salaryman's suit to give me a tour after a macrobiotic breakfast. He proceeded to walk us past an ikebana flower arrangement in the middle of the lobby, which was being pruned and restocked by a large coordinated team of black-vested human hotel employees, mute and nearly invisible, like Bunraku puppet theater stagehands, to the information station, an LCD touch panel advertising park activities under the vacant gaze of a portly maid robot called Sashan. We stood near Sashan while one of the Bangraku stagehands vacuumed the floor around us with a long, slender, ergonomic dustbuster. Takata-san explained that the hotel had 72 rooms and only 10 human staff members. The staff members were present for emergencies, should they arise, and cleaning. In the future, the hotel hopes to replace even those with cleaning robots. The check-in robot staff at the Hina-na Hotel are the work of Kokoro, a Tokyo-based subsidiary of Sanrio, the parent company of Hello Kitty. One of its robotics engineers told me that Japan has been in the vanguard of robotics because the Japanese, who tend at once to see the inanimate as lifelike, even used sewing needles possess souls, and human behavior as frequently robotic, as so many exchanges are so carefully scripted, don't see an inherent conflict between humanity and robots. There's the expectation that robots will peacefully integrate with human society. Growing up, kids see robots in manga and anime that are friendly and integrated into human groups. Later, I sat around in the lobby a little bored. The staff walked around doing things that might be dangerous or unsuitable for robots. They watered the plants and attended to the ikebana and dust-busted up invisible mites. Now and then someone would come and check in at the robot overseeing consoles, but they never spoke to the stagehands. At a certain point in the afternoon, the stagehands were at an obvious loss for further work, and three of them took the robot porters out to stretch their gears. One stagehand porter pair went up the ramp to the second floor, another down the ramp to the first. The whole tableau was like a scene from Blade Runner on Ambien. The comedy of the Velociraptor had faded, and I felt lonely and very far from human comfort. It wasn't that a robot can't be a convincing friend because it's only performing. It's that, for now at least, there's no plasticity or surprise to the performance. The thing a human can do that a machine can't yet is reprogram itself. As far as our robot future goes, assuming an automated superintelligence stops somewhere short of human enslavement or genocide, we're likely to find that we greatly miss some human interactions. I wished I were over at the 5-star Hotel Europa, where at least I could tip a bartender to talk to me. As I sat there, a young Scottish woman came in, stopped, a stagehand, and began to cry. A Japanese tourist who spoke a little English ran over to help her. She had been traveling with her Japanese friend, and her Japanese friend had stalked off in a fit, abandoning her. She had a reservation for the night, but not enough money to pay for the whole room. And she had no credit card. She was desperate, she said, and it had been her dream to come stay in the robot hotel. She had only about 2/3 of what she needed to check in. She begged for a discount. But the Bunraku stagehand only gestured inertly at the Velociraptor, as if to indicate that he had no more control over the situation than the mechanical dinosaur did. The Velociraptor shrugged and growled. She begged everyone assembled to give her money. But after having listened for a while, I found her story increasingly fishy and wasn't moved by her plight. She seemed to me like a lying human. Finally, after many tears, one of the Bunraku stagehands came out from a back room with a piece of paper. He had spent 20 minutes calling around to all the hotels in the area, and he had found the one whose rooms cost exactly the cash she could afford. He had made her a reservation there and would drive her through the rain in his friend's car. It was a tremendously touching gesture. She was, however, unconsoled and shook her head. But she sputtered at last, "I came for the robots." This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in Wired. On the Health and Science page, averting a post-antibiotic apocalypse. Antibiotic-resistant bacteria could become a bigger killer than cancer by 2050 unless drastic action is taken to curb the excessive use of existing drugs and spur the development of new ones. That's the stark conclusion of a major 2-year review of antimicrobial resistance. The dwindling arsenal of effective antibiotics could make minor infections and routine surgeries like C-sections life-threatening. The report estimates that drug-resistant superbugs, which already kill 700,000 people a year, could claim as many as 10 million lives each year by the middle of the century. Just this week, researchers reported finding a superbug resistant to antibiotics of the last resort in a Pennsylvania woman, suggesting that such untreatable bacteria may become prevalent in the U.S. The study's authors, who were commissioned by the British government, make several proposals. They advise governments to set strict limits on the use of antibiotics in agriculture and to provide significant financial incentives for pharmaceutical companies to develop new antibiotics. They also recommended launching a global awareness campaign to increase understanding of antimicrobial resistance. We need to inform in different ways all over the world why it's crucial we stop treating our antibiotics like sweets, study author Jim O'Neill tells BBC.com. If we don't solve the problem, we are heading to the dark ages, and we will have a lot of people dying. Ocean views ease stress. Would you prefer to live by a park or by the ocean? If you want lower stress levels, it may be worth opting for the water view, says NYMag.com. Researchers from Michigan State University gathered mental health data of residents in Wellington, New Zealand, and looked at how much green or blue space each person could see from their home. They found that people within sight of the ocean reported significantly less psychological distress than those with views of playing fields, parks, or forests, even when accounting for differences in residents' age, income, and neighborhood crime rates. It's unclear if the ocean's soothing effects are linked to the salty breeze and rhythmic waves, or if views of lakes or rivers would offer similar advantages. But the researchers believe their findings could identify ways to help manage mental illness. We're living in an increasingly urbanized world, says the study's co-author, Amber Pearson. So if we can find features in cities that promote mental health, this is really going to help us in the future. On the Talking Points page, a death at the zoo. Why was a gorilla shot? Fascinated by Harambe, a western lowland gorilla at the Cincinnati Zoo, a four-year-old boy last week crawled through a wood and wire barrier to get closer to the endangered animal. He tumbled into the enclosure, landing in a shallow moat. At first, the immensely powerful 450-pound ape seemed to be acting protectively toward the youngster, gently standing him up out of the water. But as panicked onlookers screamed, Harambe grew agitated and dragged the child through the water by the ankle. After a harrowing 10 minutes, zoo staff shot the gorilla dead, which unleashed an outpouring of grief that quickly turned to fury, said Peter Holly in the Washington Post. Animal advocates started a Justice for Harambe Facebook page that got more than 100,000 likes and circulated online petitions calling for the boy's mother to be investigated for negligence. Some critics called the gorilla's death murder, but Zoo Director Thane Maynard said officials had to act immediately to save the child's life. "We're talking about an animal that I've seen crush a coconut with one hand." Apparently, animal lovers care more about the ape than the human, said Christy Blatchford in the National Post. The zoo killed Harambe because they feared shooting him with a tranquilizer dart might further agitate him and would take minutes to knock him out. Not that the death of such a magnificent creature isn't a great shame, but the outpouring of outrage is ridiculous. Justice for Harambe? Enough already. Don't blame the boy's parents either, said Alyssa Strauss in Slate.com. I've had to take my eyes off my three-year-old son for a variety of reasons, most of which involved digging through the bottom of his stroller to locate sunscreen or his water bottle. There is no parent who has never looked away from his or her child for even a moment. People who insist Harambe shouldn't have been shot to save the boy either don't have kids or hate their kids, said Tony Norman in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. These critics should channel their misplaced rage toward ending gorilla incarceration at zoos altogether. Gorillas are cousins of our species and have thoughts and feelings. Like orcas, they shouldn't be penned up in tight, boring enclosures to be gawked at by paying customers. The era of gorilla enclosures, no matter how humane, has passed. And we've got time for a few short notes. About 46% of Americans say they do not have enough available money to cover a $400 emergency expense, a slight improvement from 2013 when the figure was 50%. About half of the misogynistic tweets containing the word slut and whore during a recent three-week period were sent by women, according to a new study by the think tank Demos. Between Memorial Day and Labor Day, Americans eat 7 billion hot dogs, or about 818 per second. On the poll watch, 38% of registered voters are indifferent about the possibility of Hillary Clinton becoming the first ever female president. 22% expressed enthusiasm, and 16% said it made them uncomfortable. And we'll finish with a quote from Coach John Wooden. He says, "Things turn out best for the people who make the best out of the way things turn out." We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.